Afternoon, everyone. Greetings from Baltimore. As previously stated, my name is Stacy Page, and I work in the Division of Appeals Policy
This meeting is
with the
being recorded.
Medicare Enrollment and Appeals Group here at CMS. I'm happy to be joining you all today virtually to talk about the Part C and D Enrollee Grievance Organization Coverage Determinations and Appeals Guidance Updates. I apologize for not being able to attend in person, but of course the first snowfall of the season here in Baltimore just would not be the same without me to complain about it, so of course I had to stay. Joking aside, though, I'm not here to complain about the impending snow, which we should be getting this evening. I'm here to go over the changes that came with the new version of Grievance and Appeals Guidance that merged Chapter 13 of the Medicare Managed Care Manual and Chapter 18 of the Prescription Drug Benefit Manual that was released in February of this year. While much of the content remained the same when the chapters were merged, a number of changes were made, which is what we'll get into today. Next slide, please. So first I'm going to touch on the objectives and what we're going to go over today. The objectives are to provide an overview of why the chapters were merged and other general changes that were made, to point out significant regulatory changes which appeared for the first time in sub-regulatory guidance, discuss important policy changes and identify specific clarifications that were made in this version of guidance, and to review the upcoming regulation changes for 2020. So first we'll talk about the decision to merge the guidance and some of the general changes that were made. Next slide. So when the guidance was first released, the fact that it was one manual for both Part C and D grievance and appeals was a big announcement. There were a lot of questions about how much of the information within the manual is different and how the merging would impact plan operations. Ideally, we wanted to avoid additional burden to plans, and the true intent of merging the two chapters was to streamline guidance and eliminate confusion. We wanted to make it easier to read and to follow so it's a more efficient document. Making sure that it flowed and could be read in the order of the appeals process was one of our goals, and instead of just flipping through unnumbered pages and trying to get information from two separate documents, you can now find everything in the same place, and it's easier to find exactly what you're looking for. One of the benefits of combining C and D is that it's shorter. By combining the chapters, we drastically reduced the total number of pages of guidance. If you include the table of contents in the appendices, Chapter 13, the previous Chapter 13, was 105 pages, and Chapter 18 was 138 pages. Once we merged the guidance together, they were, when they were put together, they were over 240 pages. But the combined guidance, which includes the same information as both Chapters 13 and 18, is only 104 pages. We were able to cut down the number of pages by removing or condensing duplicative and repetitive information. We took some of the content that was repeated in several different sections of the guidance and put it in one place in the new merged guidance and cross-referenced it in all the other applicable sections. And for those who prefer to use the document electronically, going to an applicable section within the guidance can be accessed easily by clicking a link of the appropriate section number. Next slide. Other changes include implementing plain, universal terminology where applicable to both Part C and Part D. Because the guidance is for both Part C and Part D, unless it's otherwise specified in guidance, using the same terms to understand when guidance was applicable to both is vital. A couple of examples include saying initial determination when we're referring to both organization and coverage determinations, saying coverage request when talking about both organization and coverage determination, level one appeal when we're discussing either a redetermination or a reconsideration at the plan level, and using the term plans so that everyone understands that the guidance is applicable to both Medicare health plans and Part D plan sponsors. It was just as important to note where guidance was only applicable to Part C or Part D. And in those instances, it's clearly separated and easily identifiable, and the applicable terms are used. So, for example, you'll see a table that starts with Part C only as a heading and contains language like MA plans must process redeterminations using the following timeframes. So by boxing this information off with a title and using the terms MA plans and redeterminations helps to clearly indicate that the section is for Part C only. We also modified the formatting of guidance, and we made several structural changes. One of the bigger changes was the use of tables throughout guidance. As I just mentioned, we use tables to identify when a section or a portion is applicable to Part C or Part D only. And we converted long narratives into these easy-to-read tables that you'll see throughout the guidance. We also restructured the order so that readers could go to the table of contents and find specific sections or information more easily. We also reduced the number of terms in the glossary, so it only includes terms that are not defined in specific sections of guidance. An example is organization determination. We previously had that in the glossary, but we found that it really wasn't inclusive of, you know, the regulatory definition, so we decided to keep that in the section for organization determinations. Another change is the use of hyperlinks where relevant resources are cited. This includes both references to other sections within guidance, as well as links to CMS web pages, standardized notices, model notices, and other applicable guidance. A number of changes throughout the guidance were made following a request for feedback from plans and plan sponsors of a draft version of guidance via an open comment period in October of 2018. Next slide, please. For those of you that provided comments when we had our open feedback period, thank you very much. A number of our changes were made based on the feedback that we received. While we anticipated getting a lot of responses, we really didn't expect to get such a high volume of individual comments. After posting our request for feedback, we received over 100 emails, 105 emails. And once we read through each response and started sorting through the list of comments in each response, we identified 684 separate comments and suggestions for guidance. It was a lot to go through, but your feedback was very helpful and vital to making sure that the guidance was useful. Overall, the response to the merged guidance was positive, and a majority of plans and plan sponsors thought that merging was helpful. So now we'll get to, I guess, the meat and potatoes of the presentation, the content within the guidance. So we'll start with the three Part D and the one Part C changes in regulation that were added to merged guidance. Next slide. The first addition was for Part D at-risk determinations, which in guidance can be found in Section 40.3. As most of us know, an at-risk determination is a decision made under a plan sponsor's drug management program that involves identification as an at-risk enrollee for prescription drug abuse, a limitation or the continuation of a limitation on access to coverage for frequently abused drugs, and information sharing for subsequent plan enrollments. At-risk determinations are subject to the Part D appeals process, so if an enrollee disagrees with the at-risk determination, then they have the right to request a redetermination. Enrollees will receive a notice that explains their appeal rights, that includes the redetermination request must be received within 60 days of that notice. So the same Part D appeals timeframes are applicable for at-risk determinations. We want to note that in addition to the right to appeal an at-risk determination, an enrollee always has the right to request a coverage determination, including an exception for a drug that they believe may be covered. Next slide. The second reg change for Part D was with tiering exceptions, which is in Section 40.5.1 in guidance. In previous guidance, if a plan utilized a tiered cost-sharing structure to manage its Part D drug benefits, it was required to establish and maintain reasonable and complete exceptions procedures that allowed enrollees to obtain a non-preferred drug in a higher cost-sharing tier at the more favorable cost-sharing terms applicable to drugs in a lower cost-sharing tier. Now, plans are not required to offer tiering exceptions for brand-name drugs or biological products at the cost-sharing level of alternative drugs, where the alternatives include only generic or authorized generic drugs. Next slide. The third Part D reg that was added to guidance was a change to the redetermination reconsideration payment timeframes. The timeframes to issue decisions previously was 7 days, and with this change, the timeframe to process redeterminations is now 14 days. Guidance also says this is applicable to Level 2 appeals or the independent review entity reconsideration. Next slide. So the last regulation change added to guidance is only for Part C. There was a change regarding notification to enrollees. previously, plans were required to send enrollees notification that their adverse organization determination was upheld on appeal and that their case was being forwarded to the independent review entity or the IRE. Once the case was received by the IRE was also sending enrollee notification, so the enrollee was receiving two notices. With the regulation change, plans are no longer required to notify enrollees that their case is forwarded to the IRE. The enrollee will be notified by the IRE. This change is found, I think, in a few sections with or subsections within Section 50. And since this was implemented, we have received a few questions regarding whether or not plans should continue to send notifications to enrollees. The regulation is not prohibiting plans from sending notifications. It just clarifies that you're no longer required to send notice. So if it's in your plan policy to continue to send notification to enrollees that the decision was upheld and the case is forwarded, then you are permitted to do so. So that wraps up the changes to guidance based on the changes to reg. So now I'll go over other policy changes and clarifications that were made to guidance. And we'll go through each one by section. Next slide. So the first section, Section 10, we added new information to guidance that was primarily based on frequently asked questions from plans and plan sponsors. And one question that came up a lot was, when does the clock start? Is it day one or is it day zero? With guidance, CMS clarified that day one is the day after the receipt of the request because one day has elapsed. So for example, if a request is received on December 10th that has a processing time frame of 7 days, it must be completed by December 17th. Time frames and hours will follow the same logic, the number of hours from the time the request was received. So if an expedited request or a request with 72-hour time frame is received at 12 o'clock noon on December 10th, it must be completed by 12 p.m. Noon on December 13th. And the guidance explains this in more detail, and it also provides some examples for both Part C and Part D timeframes. Next slide. Also, in Section 10, we included new guidance for when a request is considered received by the plan and when notification is considered delivered. There was information in previous guidance regarding when a request is considered received. However, it was in a number of places throughout the chapter. So in the merged guidance, we put this information in its own subsection, which is 10.5.2, and we use bullet points to more clearly identify when various types of requests are considered received. A few examples that we added were when written requests are received by mail or when verbal requests are left on a plan or plan sponsor's voicemail system. We also added guidance for when requests are received through a website or portal, and when requests are received directly by the plan versus a delegated entity. Since the release of this guidance, we've gotten a number of questions about getting clarification for when standard versus expedited requests are received by a delegated entity, and if the guidance further in the chapter in Section 50.2.1 regarding expedited requests is applicable. To address this question, the note in Section 10.5.2, this current section, is how CMS determines when standard and expedited requests are considered received. Next slide. So one last update in Section 10 that I'd like to discuss is Section 10.6, the outreach for additional information to support coverage decisions. We received a lot of comments and suggestions regarding the addition of this section, primarily because it slightly differed from the first HPMS memo that we issued on this topic in 2017. We added this section to provide additional clarification regarding CMS's interpretation of the regulatory requirements for conducting outreach when plans and plan sponsors don't have enough information to make a pre-service or pre-benefit coverage decision. As we explained in guidance, only one outreach attempt to collect additional information is required. And we also included some best practices in this section to help plans increase the likelihood of obtaining necessary information. Now we'll go on to changes in Section 20, the section on representatives. So we can go to the next slide. There were a few items in Section 20 that were not in Chapters 13 and 18 that I'd like to point out. We added some information in Section 20.1, representatives filing on behalf of enrollees. because we received a number of questions about the validity of an enrollee verbally appointing a representative. By regulation, verbal appointment of a representative is not permitted, and enrollees must submit a written valid representative form. We heard that there are instances when an enrollee calls with a family member or someone that they want to help them make a request, so we included additional guidance for plans on how they may appropriately process these requests. So in these situations, if an enrollee indicates that they want to file a request, the plans would document this as a request from the enrollee and would inform the enrollee that if their purported representative wanted to receive communication, then they would need to submit a valid AOR form. We also included another new section, section 20.2.1, regarding how plans can process missing or defective representative forms when they receive them. We also included guidance for when a request is considered received if a form is missing or invalid. So we clarified that plans may begin a review while waiting on the form, the corrected form, but are not required to, and that a decision must not be issued until a valid form is obtained, which is when the clock, the processing clock starts. Next slide. Last subsection to note within section 20 is 20.3, the authority of a representative. In previous guidance, there was a good bit of confusion about the requirements for notification when a representative is involved. In this merged guidance, we included information that explains correspondence would go to the representative and that plans are permitted to send notices or correspondence to both an enrollee and a representative, but are not required to send to both. Next slide. Now we'll go to section 30. Section 30 talks about grievances, and we included a section about classification that wasn't specifically carved out in previous guidance. Section 30.1 is intended to assist plans and plan sponsors with appropriately classifying grievances, inquiries, coverage requests, and appeals. This new subsection provides examples of how to classify different types of requests and also includes guidance on how to handle misclassified requests. One notable addition to the guidance within this section is plans having to inform an enrollee if an issue is a grievance or an appeal. When the guidance was released, we did receive questions about what's considered acceptable notification in these instances. In the guidance, it does state that plans have the flexibility to inform an enrollee either verbally or in writing. And most plans already have these policies and procedures in place that meet this requirement. So, for example, if a verbal request comes in and a customer service representative explains to an enrollee that the steps or process for a grievance or appeal are X, Y, and Z, then they're actually providing notification that their request is a grievance or an appeal. It's kind of identifying that the request is a grievance or an appeal. If a written request comes in, an acknowledgement letter that the request has been received counts towards notifying the enrollee. That is not saying that there is a requirement to send an acknowledgement of a written request, but just that if plans do that, then that is an acceptable form of notification. We do understand that there are a number of scenarios that may be questionable with this new addition to guidance, so if you're unsure if an enrollee is correctly notified, then please submit a question to our online portal. I'll provide the website address at the end of the presentation for that. One other change to Section 30 very quickly is just the addition of a separate subsection for quality of care grievances. It's Section 30.3. No new information there, just kind of noting that we kind of carved that out so it's a little more easily identifiable, and it provides information on how to process quality of care grievances. Next slide. For Section 40, we had one addition that I just would like to mention very quickly, which is only applicable to Part C. Most plans are already aware, but we just noted that for Part C, a request for a prior authorization is an organization determination, which means that plans must process them as a request for an OD, and all of the OD rules are applicable in those instances. Next slide. The last few changes I'm going to touch on this afternoon are found throughout multiple sections of guidance. So instead of going section by section and giving repetitive information, I'm just going to go over various changes and that they're found in multiple sections. So The first is addressing another frequently asked question that we've received over the years. How should plans notify enrollees of favorable determinations? So throughout sections 40 and 50, under notice requirements, we included how to handle favorable determinations or notice for favorable determinations. For Part C, we clarified that plans are not required to notify enrollees in writing of a favorable organization determination, but we encourage plans to adopt a best practice of sending them in writing. For favorable Part D coverage determinations and Level 1 appeals for both C and D, notification must be in writing. We also added to guidance that plans may expedite payment requests. I wanted to point this out during this presentation just to provide clarification that if a plan is asked by a party to expedite a request for payment, they're not required to do so, but plans are also not prohibited from doing so. So choosing to expedite a request for payment is at the discretion of the plan, and plans are not penalized if they choose to expedite requests for payment. Next slide. Another notable area that was added to guidance is regarding dismissals and withdrawals. In sections 30, 40, and 50, we added subsections on how to process a request to withdraw a grievance, initial determination, and appeal. For dismissals, we added a subsection, 50.9, that explains when MA plans should dismiss a reconsideration request. We received a lot of questions about dismissals for grievances and initial determinations and why there isn't a specific section like there is for appeals. For grievances and initial determinations, there are very few circumstances where a plan would dismiss a request. So these are actually addressed in places within guidance where it would be applicable. So for grievances, it would be if a grievance is filed past the 60-day deadline, or for both a grievance and an initial determination, a valid AOR form is not received. So for missing the filing deadline, the plan can either accept a grievance past the 60 days or dismiss the request. And this is found in a footnote in the chart in section 30.2 of guidance. For a valid or invalid or missing AOR, plans should send notice to the enrollee requesting that they submit a valid form, and then they can dismiss if one is not received at the expiration of the appropriate adjudication timeframe plus any applicable extension. We did get some questions about what the expiration of the time frame is, and we have told plans that the expiration of the time frame is the day after the last day. So, for example, if the last day of the time frame is Wednesday, then the enrollee has, you know, all day Wednesday to submit the form, and the plan may dismiss the request on Thursday. More information on dismissing for invalid or missing AOR forms can be found in section 20.2.1. So that wraps up the notable changes that are in guidance. But before we conclude, I want to talk about two changes to the appeals regulations that are going to be effective in 2020. Next slide. So there are two reg changes that are applicable to Part C and Part D. The first final rule adopts new adjudication timeframe requirements for organization determinations and plan reconsiderations related to requests for Part B drugs, and this is for the Part C side. The final rule was posted in the Federal Register in May, and effective January 1st, 2020, Part B drugs will be processed under the same adjudication timeframes as used in the Part D drug program. These deadlines will also apply to the Part C independent review entity or IRE reconsiderations. We've gotten a few questions already about whether or not these timeframes are going to apply to payment requests for Part B drugs. And to clarify, the final rule is applicable only to pre-service requests for Part B drugs and not payment requests. Also, the rules related to extending adjudication timeframes do not apply to the new Part B drug timeframes. So plans cannot extend timeframes for pre-service requests for Part B drugs. Next slide, please. The second final rule specifies if a supporting statement is not received by the end of the 14 calendar days from receipt of an exceptions request, a Part D plan sponsor must notify the enrollee and the prescribing physician or other prescriber involved as appropriate of its determination as expeditiously as the enrollee's health condition requires, but no later than 72 hours or 24 hours for an expedited request. From the end of the 14 calendar days, from receipt of the exception request. That's a mouthful. So for part D, this is actually in guidance as a recommended time frame. You can find that at section 40.5.4. So this is something that it's kind of been seen before, but the final rule for this was posted in Federal Register in April, and this becomes effective January 1st, 2020. So those are the two regulatory changes for 2020 that impact appeals and grievances. We've talked a lot today about the merging of the appeals and grievance guidance and the changes and clarifications that were made and what changes are happening in 2020. Now, I know that given the regs that there are probably questions surrounding updates to guidance and the notice of denial for Part C, the IDN integrated denial notice for those Part B drug timeframes. For guidance, we're going to be issuing updates that will include the Part B drug timeframes for coverage and the timeframes for coverage determinations involving exceptions. And until that guidance is updated, then we are encouraging plans to just follow the regulations and always feel free to submit questions to us via our online portal. Regarding the IDN, because it's a standardized notice that requires OMB approval, it has to go through the Paperwork Reduction Act process, the PRA process. As of today, it is in the final stages of the PRA process. Updated form and OMB effective expiration date will be posted on the Medicare Advantage Appeals and Grievances CMS.gov website and will be sent in a memorandum via HPMS as soon as the information is available. We do understand that the date it expires is coming up, I believe it's January of 2020, but plans may continue to use the current form until a revised form and effective date are published. Next slide. So that concludes the presentation on guidance updates. And before I take questions, I want to remind everyone of the new Appeals and Grievances portal for Part C and Part D questions. In case you missed it, this past fall, Division of Appeals Policy implemented a new website portal for plans and plan sponsors to submit questions instead of the Part C or Part D appeals at cms.hhs.gov email address. If you have questions following this presentation, they can be submitted to us at the website that's on the slide, appeals.lmi.org. Please be sure to submit your question via the portal. If you use the email address, you'll receive a message indicating the email address is not valid. Those emails do not come to us, so we don't know if questions are being received that way or not. We're only getting questions through the website portal. So with that, I would like to thank you all for your time, and I would be happy to take any questions that anyone may have, if there's time for questions.
So does anyone have any questions for Stacy? I think there are a couple over here. I'm going to hope that she can hear us.
Hi, Molly Colombo from Scan Health Plan. I had a question about the tiering exception 40.5.1. We're seeing that some PBMs are dismissing cases as described here, and then some are denying the cases. Do you guys have a recommendation of what you want plans to do with those?
I unfortunately, I wish I could answer your question. I don't have that information with me handy. My Part D SME subject matter expert is actually not with me today to help answer questions. So if you could submit your question via the portal, we would receive it today and we'll hopefully get an answer to you by tomorrow, if possible. I apologize.
Hi, I'm Susie McMichael from Epic Management. We actually are fully delegated, and we ask that the providers actually send the PA forms through the pharmacy benefits prior to requesting specialized drugs. And we have a really hard time getting those back because we do find that a lot of the specialty drugs may be covered under the Part D benefit before it becomes a Part B benefit. With the time frames going from the 72 hours to, from 14 days to 72 hours, it's very hard to make those, especially if we're waiting for somebody else to answer whether if it's going to be covered under the Part D or not. Do you have any recommendations for that?
If you could, again, and I hate to defer this to the mailbox, but because this is a new regulation that's going to be effective in 2020, if you could submit that information and be as specific as possible into that portal, we're going to kind of do what we can because we don't have the updated guidance as of yet to go ahead and answer those questions as best as possible and see if maybe we can put some information on the website to kind of provide additional information or additional guidance on that. So if anyone actually has any questions specifically related to that, to the 2020 regs that are going to be implemented on January 1st, we definitely welcome those questions. We'll answer them via the portal, but we're also going to try to collect that information and see if we can kind of get that out to everyone before guidance is updated. I hope that's helpful.
Hi, Stacy. That's number two up. Hi, Stacy. This is Anthony. And I have a question that came through our conference app. And this is from Kelly Howe with Encura. And the question is, can CMS please clarify, when additional information is received by the plan following a denial of an initial determination, when should this be treated as a level one appeal, and when should this be treated as a reopening of the initial determination?
Thank you. That's a good question. It depends on the information that is received. And I don't have a specific section number for the guidance in reopenings. I believe it's in section 80, but there is a section for additional information or new or material evidence. So plans can kind of look at the information that they receive and see if it meets any of that criteria that's within that section in section 80. And if it meets that criteria, all of those criteria, then it would be considered a reopening. If not, it would be considered an appeal. I know that that's still, there are a lot of questions around that as well. So if you go through that and you kind of see what that criteria is to constitute a reopening and it still isn't super clear, then please let us know and send your question via the portal with kind of those specific examples. I know that as you kind of go through and make updates to guidance, having as much information as possible from everyone to kind of know what obstacles you're running into, it's helpful that we can kind of put whatever information would be applicable to plans within the guidance. So the subsection within Section 80 about new material evidence would determine whether or not it would be a reopening versus an appeal.
Much. We have a question right here.
Hi, I'm Steve Blunt-Canosa with Aetna. I have a question pertaining to good cause. Should the plan accept good cause verbally when it's presented with a verbal expedite appeal request? I know the guidance states that good cause needs to be in writing, but our plan would waive the good cause requirement if, during the verbal expedite request, the member stated that they called the plan during the appeal time frame, and we had documentation that the call was pertaining to the denial, or if the denial reason was for conservative treatment like physical therapy before a hip replacement, and the conservative treatment requested in the denial letter was completed, but it took longer than the 60-day time frame.
So you're asking about if plans can accept if good cause is filed, or if there is. Can you repeat real quick? I just want to make sure that I have it correct.
Hello?
Hang on 1 second.
Okay.
Thanks. Mic one.
Hello? Okay, sorry. if we can accept the good cause verbally rather than requesting it in writing, if they tell us during the call, I did the conservative therapy that you're requesting, or I called the plan and talk to a customer service rep during that appeal time frame.
Yeah, I don't believe there's anything prohibiting plans from accepting good cause verbally. And I think you mentioned in guidance the good cause exception for late filing, but it can be accepted verbally.
Is as many questions as we have time for. Thank you all very much. We're going to move on to our next session. Stacy, thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.